Okie doke. Welcome, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. We meet here every Sunday night at 8 p.m., and we talk, and we teach each other, we learn from each other, and hopefully we entertain each other. And I thank you all again for joining me this particular Sunday night at 8 p.m., when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual links. Okay, if you want to reach me via email, that would be for mailbag questions, for TechNet puzzles, to express your interest in explaining some technical issue in the news that you're very familiar with, or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a NASA or space-related story. You can reach me via my email address, which is mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to directly contact Paul, you can reach him at spacenetreport@gmail.com. As always, I collect interesting links to articles and YouTubes and such, and I post them on my link page every week, and it's available 24/7. If you got a catch of insomnia and you want to see a couple of interesting articles, at least articles I found interesting, just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to my link page. We have a chat room available. Sometimes it's busy, sometimes it's quiet. You get there by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. That'll get you there. We offer, for people who need it, a audio stream via the Internet of the TechNet, and we leave it on the rest of the week because people ask me to, so you can listen into Glen Oaks when you don't have a radio nearby. You can reach there by typing into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And I always like to remind people that MikeKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. Amateurradio.tv. It's got over a million people passing through, and it has archives that go as far back as September of 2006. Of the Limark Technical Net. So listen to the great minds that used to occupy this repeater before they moved away or unfortunately became silent keys and passed away. Still a lot of good wisdom in those audio files. So that's it for the link. Let me drop for a second and I will turn to tell you what we got planned. Okay. Not much in the artificial intelligence news. I usually start the net with that. DeepSeek has a new version out. It's still in R1 designation, but it's a more mature piece of artificial intelligence. And I'm still looking forward to read that interesting book about OpenAI from a woman. Her book is Empire of AI, where she sort of presents Sam Waldman is a kind of a used car salesman. He's fast and loose with the facts, unfortunately. So we got another one of those types of guys out there trying to make his first $1 trillion. We'll see what that becomes of everything. Anyway, so the plan is usual, calling for questions, comments, topics for discussion, hopefully amateur radio related first, although we will except science and technology of any kind, and I will try my best to help, assist, or at least point a finger at reference someplace. That should take us to approximately 10:15, and Paul WS2N will join us for the SpaceNet report, which should take us to approximately 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan. If the laws of physics continue to work the way they're supposed to, and my shack works well, and the repeater works well, and I don't get kicked off of All-Star too many times by the All-Star server over at the repeater. So that's the plan. So let the fun begin. If anyone has any questions or comments or topic for discussion tonight, please hit that push to talk. Give me your first name, your call sign, and what's the nature of your question. You don't have to exactly tell me what the question is, whether it's amateur radio related or non-amateur radio related, what have you. We'll suffice. So let the fun begin.
Enter HGN. Alpha Delta 2 Delta Uniform.
Wes and Alex recognize. Anyone else want to put their name down? Okay, hopefully as the night progresses, we'll get people who show up kind of late, but we will still accept questions from them. Wes, do you mind if I take Alex first? He usually has shorter questions than you usually have.
No, not at all. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, Alex, you're on.
Great, I hope you can hear me okay. I'm portable in Astoria. I'm buying a new house in Westchester. We're under contract. It is surrounded by tall trees. What's the best VHF, UHF solution? Is there a solution that is a wire strung up in a tree for that? Because that would end up being higher, like elevation-wise, than a pole on my roof. And is there something that could be weatherproof? Like, is that a length of ladder line J-pole that gets hoisted up there? Or I don't really know. ABCDU.
Okay, well, you know, as the old saying used to go, Dick, K2RIW, who ran this for many, 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 many years, used to have a saying that there's three important things to getting out on UHF and VHF. So those were elevation, elevation, and elevation. So the bottom line is the higher you can, because UHF and VHF is not a ionospheric propagation mechanism frequency for us, it's a line of sight. So the higher you can get the antenna, the better your line of sight generally is. So if you find that sturdy trees nearby provide a much higher altitude, then yeah, go with the tree. I don't think you necessarily have to be concerned that much with weatherproofing. Most likely you're going to use a coaxial cable as your transmission line, because those provide the most amount of isolation and weatherproofing. You know, as long as you properly shield the antenna feed point to the coaxial transmission line, that should be sufficient, I would think.
Good evening.
Good evening.
This is Brian, KF2CC. How are you, Roy?
I'm doing fine. We're kind of in the middle of chatting about Alex's new Westchester home, where he's talking about putting up a UHF, VHF antenna that's going to give him the best results.
I understand. I have a Diamond X300, which is a very big antenna, 2 meter 440, and it works pretty well.
Yeah, it's a collinear. Those work very, very well. I have some myself. It's a very common base station design, and it's reasonably sturdy. They're usually coated with fiberglass to give them, you know, a weather seal on top of everything else. But, you know, yeah, many of them work very, very well. I mean, if you want to, you can do a wire. Although for UHF, VHF, for the purposes, it depends sort of what you're planning to do. If you're planning to go for a single sideband, you want a horizontally oriented antenna. If you want a repeater or a simplex FM, you want something that's vertically polarized.
I would agree with that. Sorry to interrupt, but go ahead.
It's okay. Alex, are you out there?
I am. I have right now Diamond X50A on the roof, which is about a 5 foot PVC type kind of thing. Maybe it's fiberglass, but I don't understand how that gets hoisted up into a tree. Because you can't sit on a tree. It's kind of a, needs to be mounted to a pipe, right?
Well, yeah, but probably the best route is to find a very strong branch towards the top, nice big thick one, and bolt a piece of metal to it, and then use that as the base for a vertical antenna.
Is this a stupid idea to, like, tie a string to the top of the diamond antenna and hoist it all the way up so it's kind of just swinging around but much higher up over a tree branch?
Well, if you can figure out a stable mechanical means of doing that, you're free to. The problem is that those types of construction, as far as I'm aware, are very difficult to structurally design so that they're sturdy and they don't blow in winds and all kinds of things. Because you're still going to have a long, heavy length of coaxial cable going down into your shack. So you're going to have a weight down, you're going to have a string or something up, you're going to have, if it's not secured in any particular inflexible position, it's going to be amenable to the wind blowing across it. So, you know, how long it would survive depends upon the ingenuity of your mechanical design for it.
A PC?
Yeah, Rich?
Could you just put my name on the list for us?
Sure, will do.
So I guess to start, there's a treehouse existing on the property. I'll probably put a 12-foot dowel and zip tie that to the treehouse to get started on day one. I'll see what I can dig up and see if there's something I can literally hoist into the tree that's, you know, not like a pole, but like basically a wire that would work vertically. Does having something close to the trunk of a tree for UHF, VHF kill its propagation?
It kind of depends on the type of antenna that you're using. If you're using one that has a collinear with a series of linear antennas where the current output kind of peaks and fluctuates across the length of the antenna, it, as long as you get most of it away from the branches and the trees and the leaves, you know, dense leaves, it should be fine. I wouldn't kind of plant it in the middle of you know, a leafy, you know, bush type of portion of the tree. I'd try and get it as off to the side as humanly possible in order to kind of limit the amount of, you know, absorption, especially when it starts to rain and the leaves get wet.
Suggestion?
Yeah?
What I have seen someone do is take a tree and put, what's that kind of stuff that they use? It's like the, what plumbers use, it's like a clamp. It's a round clamp, and as you screw it in, it keeps getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And what he did was put like a flange on it of about maybe 2 feet with these band clips that would go around the tree, and this way extend it out, let's say to the right or left of a tree, and then go ahead and mount it on that piece of metal.
Okay, I mean, that introduces more mechanical problems, because now you got torque, but you got something that not only kind of can be blown down, but something that can be rotated. So ear resistance is a thing, depending upon what type of vertical antenna you finally decide on, how tall it is and how thin it is and other things. So you got a lot of interesting forces acting on it. You got weight and you got rotation.
Well, there isn't any rotation because the band clamp, it would be like an L-shaped flange. So the L part of it, the top of the L, inverted, would be attached to the tree with the band clamp. And then that would go out for about either 2 to 3 feet. And then the antenna would be mounted on the end of it vertically. And it managed to work for him, no problem.
Okay, again, it sort of depends on a bunch of things. It depends upon the mechanical strength of that L unit and the weight and the ear resistance of the antenna. As you bring the weight of the antenna up and as you bring the ear resistance of the antenna up, the fact that it's not bolted directly to something but kind of extended a couple of feet introduced that other force that I was talking about. It might not be important in that situation depending upon how you set all the other variables, but it's within possibilities that if you put too much weight down and you don't have enough structural support on the L column, that the metal might twist down from the force of gravity working on a 90-degree angle. So, almost anything can be engineered to be sturdy, but some are more difficult to figure out than others.
Okay.
I will definitely try it out. I think, is a dumb question. Would the Diamond X50A antenna work upside down, or would it just radiate into the ground in that case? I don't know whether they radiate horizontally or horizontally and vertically. Because if I could get it over a tree and have it just hang, that would work too.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, as long as you keep it away from close to the ground, the orientation, a vertical ground plane vertical operates in outer space where there's no orientation of what's vertical, horizontal, or ground. So, I mean, theoretically, if you invert it, as long as you raise it off the ground too much, if you put it real close to the ground, though, you might get ground coupling and you'll have a power loss before it ever has a chance to radiate significantly. But, you know, as long as you keep it significantly above the ground, it's an unusual thing because now you have ground planes on the top instead of on the bottom. That's not that important if it's very high off of the ground because the two things that radials do is to isolate you from ground coupling. If your vertical is close to the ground, that's why you can get away with 3 or 4 radials when the vertical is elevated. But if you have it planted straight on the ground, you need more, something like 36 radials just to block it from coupling to the ground. So as long as you have it elevated, it's a very weird thing to have ground planes at the top, but in that case, they're really not ground planes, they're just counterpoises. And you can have a counterpoise any direction. Again, unless you put it really close to the ground and you have it coupling with earth ground and losing power that way.
Great. Well, thank you for the information. And thank you, Wesley, for letting me sneak in first. And I'll be listening on the side. I may have another question for you later. Alpha Delta 2 Delta Uniform.
Talk. And if you have any other questions later on tonight, feel free to shout them out. Wesley, do you mind if Rich goes first?
No, go ahead. Take Rich.
Okay, Rich, you're on.
Okay, good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody. This question has to do with wire antennas in a tree also. I had a guy climb a tree up 40 feet and tie the end of the wire, 66-foot long wire, to a branch. Now, when I measured it, I saw I had to trim some of the wire to get close to resonant. This is a half-wave end fed. But I trimmed enough to wonder whether this now has become a random wire as opposed to a half-wave wire. So what I did last night was I bought a 1-to-9 transformer. Right now I'm using a 49-to-1. And the question is, how do you know when you have to switch from a 49-to-1 to a 9-to-1 or vice versa? Because now my wire may be a random wire rather than an N-fed half-wave wire. It may be an N-fed random wire, and that requires a 9-to-1 balance. So, and if I try it, what could be the consequences, or what should I see when I try it? Go ahead.
Okay, AC2GS, by the way. The whole point, once again, of a 49-to-1 or a 64-to-1, something along those lines, is that if your the actual electrical length of your N-fed wire is approximately one-half of a wavelength of the frequency that you're looking to use, it should be the highest impedance attainable. Now, theoretically, we talked about before real life and theoretical life. In theoretical life, if you plug in the proper equations, the impedance at the end fed of a half wave is an infinity. But as we mentioned repeatedly, we don't live in theory world. We live in practical world, and you never really get an exact half wavelength of wire. It's always a little under, a little over, so the average N-fed impedance at resonance of a half wave, N-fed, is anywhere from about 2,000 to 3,000 ohms. So if your wire is cut correctly, it should be somewhere in the 2,000 to 3,000 ohm area. And you would need something as significant as a 49 or a 64-to-1 to reduce that 3,000 ohms impedance to someplace close to 50 ohms where you could deal with it properly. If you've cut it to a different length, it won't get anywhere close to 2 to 3,000 ohms, and it will go to 1,000, 1,000 and change, whatever. And in those cases, 9-to-1 is more than enough. If you try 49-to-1, your impedance would get much too small for anything close to 50 ohms. So ultimately, it depends upon what your impedance from your VNA says it is at the output of whatever you plan to use. If you try to sweep your unun with the 49-to-1 and you get some impedance level that's close to 50 ohms, it means that you cut the wire for a half wavelength end fed. If it has significantly less than that coming out of it, then you might want to switch to a 9-to-1 and see if the 9-to-1 gives you an impedance output close to 50 ohms. And that would kind of indicate that it's operating more as a non-resident, semi-random half end-fed antenna. You understand?
Yeah, no, I understand that, but the operative word is significantly. My question is, when does it cross over from a half wave to a random wire? You know, at what length?
It's not a binary. It's a gradual decline. When you cut the end fed to a perfect half wave, theoretically, again, because nothing's absolute, it's somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000. As you snip it more and more. It goes down. It'll go down from 2,500 to 2,000 to 1,500 to 1,000 to 800, and it just keeps on going down. So there's no kind of way to easily say, well, at the point where the impedance goes down to 1,000 ohms, then it's just a random. The closer the length is, so that a 9-to-1 will give you a reasonable impedance around the 50 ohm level to it being transformed, is effectively when it's operating most like a random non-resident headset. That's the best I could give you. There's no magic number. At when the impedance is such and such, it is now no longer anything close to a half wave. It becomes a worse and worse half wave until it becomes an abysmal half wave, and then you just have to treat it as a random non-resident NSET.
Okay, so let's say I don't have a nano VNA and I can't measure the impedance. What would I see, anowacked SWR on all the bands if I switch to a 9-to-1?
Wesley, is that you? You're very, very low amplitude.
Yes. What I'm saying is repeater got disconnected for some reason, and you are not dead. I mean, for echolink.
Yeah, no, I know. I just watched it go down. Hopefully it'll reboot.
Okay, go ahead.
Echo 2, Yankee Golf.
Yes, Sam. What can I do you for?
You have a 5-foot diamond antenna versus a 10-foot diamond antenna. Vertical. What would be the difference between the 5 feet and 10 feet? And don't say 5 feet.
I wouldn't do that to you, Sam. Well, effectively, you're going to be able, assuming what it is a collinear. It's basically it's two small verticals stacked on top of each other. So what benefit does co-stacking verticals on top of each other? Well, effectively what it does is it squashes down the radiation pattern. It makes it somewhat flatter, and that's usually a good thing because especially for repeaters, you're trying to just hit the repeater antenna. And the less you kind of shoot too high or shoot too low, the better. So the amount of gain increases with the number of collinear stacks of verticals that you use.
BC.
Yeah, Rich?
Maybe I haven't finished. That's a whole different question, or I was still trying to ascertain some stuff about switching from a 49 to a 9. So could I continue with that?
UHF. It's directional.
Okay, you got a lot of people doubling. I'm sorry, Rich. I just thought it was a simple kind of addition to the same basic question. I think that was prior to you. That was Alex's. So I thought I could kind of give the answer quickly and move back to you. I haven't forgotten at all about you, Rich.
Okay.
So, Sam, do you understand the answer that you get a little bit better directionality, a little bit more of the juice is directed at the repeater antenna that you're most interested in?
Yes, I did. Thank you very much for explaining that to me very simply. Got it. Thank you.
Okie doke, very good. And unfortunately, as Wesley mentioned, Echo Link kind of disconnected and went down. I don't know why. The website seems to indicate it's still around, but it's not on my connection, so hopefully reset. And if not, someone out there who has quick access to it might be able to reset it. We'll see what happens. Anyway, getting back to you, Rich. So I mean, ultimately, it's shades of gray. You know, at what point is it not black? Well, you know, it's never quite black, but it's very close to black at some points. And in the same way that it's never truly a fully halfway then fed, because again, theoretically, at that point, the impedance would be infinity, and there's no antenna that works like that in real life. So it's a matter of best case scenarios. If your antenna works better with a 49 or a 64-to-1 on them, then it's a functionally an end-fed half-wave. If you find that it's really awful, and as an experiment, you stick a 9-to-1 to replace the 48-to-1, and you find that the VNA sweep or just functionally operation of that antenna is better for you than it was when it had the 64-to-1 or the lesser on then you know that it's better off as a non-resonant, treating it as a non-resonant end-set.
So what I was asking, if I switch it to a 9-to-1 and it's still really a half wave, what am I going to see? Out of whack SWRs?
Yeah. You're going to see the impedances are not going to track the way an end-fed half-wave tracks. The dips in the harmonics work out very nicely with a slightly corrected half-wave end-fed. You still have to put here a little bit of an inductor or a little bit of a capacitor in line to kind of offset. Otherwise, it'll vaguely, as the harmonics go, it'll go farther and farther off the ham band. But you'll get closer to them with the proper balance than the improper balance.
Okay, and I noticed that they had, you know, the box open for the 9-to-1 that I bought, and I didn't see a capacitor in it. Is there any reason why a 9-to-1 wouldn't have a capacitor and a 49-to-1 would?
Yeah, sometimes simpler balance don't require a capacitor. They don't have quite the amount of inductance that makes the on itself resonant. You don't want a resonant balun. You want a broad frequency balun. So it's more necessary to correct these problems with a 49-to-1 than it is to a 4-to-1 or even some cases a 9-to-1. It depends upon the design of the balun. Some require correction with a capacitor. But as you get them to be higher and higher impedance transforming, it becomes difficult to design them without that aspect. So you might be able to get away with it with a 9-to-1, but I haven't seen any ununs that could do that at the higher ratios.
Okay, well, when I get it, I'm going to swap it out. How do you, by the way, measure impedance with the nano VNA? There's no direct way to do it, is there? It just doesn't say impedance, and you click on that, and it comes up, you know, with the impedance of the antenna. Is there?
Yes. Is that you, Wesley?
No, it wasn't me.
Oh, okay. Did someone else want to put their comment in? Okay. It sort of depends on the VNA. I think in the case of the nano VNA, it's very weird in that There's no real nice, clean one that says it. You can sort of infer it by the SWR. You know that a 1-to-1 SWR sweep, it means that it's a 50-ohm impedance, and you can extrapolate by the SWR curve or when you sweep it approximately what impedance it is. Actually, if you go back to your Smith chart, although it's very difficult to interpret it, you can actually just trace the marking on the curve, and I think they actually will give you information about what the frequency is and what the impedance at that frequency. Because the Smith curve is a normalized impedance chart along with a whole bunch of other features.
Okay. I wonder if the rig expert gives you a direct impedance function where you just press a button and boom, it pops up. Impedance is, because I should be getting, hopefully this week, I should be getting a new Rig Expert 55. But I will, I'll give this a try. I think it's a worthy experiment because I have cut more than a foot off of the half wave. And I don't want to cut any more because I'm a little weirded out that I cut the amount I did and the antenna, you know, the sweep just didn't fall in perfect line. So I don't want to ruin something that's 40 feet up in a tree that's working well. But as you know me, Roy, I tend to do that. I take working antennas and I turn them into non-working antennas. W2BC.
Yeah, you're kind of going by the Peter principle of engineering, unfortunately. So, I mean, one of the unfortunate problems is that you tell me that you tried to cut away something and you didn't get any kind of perfect sweep. Again, you got to keep in mind it's a complicated SWR when it comes to a proper half-wave end set. That the lowest frequency that the half wave is cut for is hopefully going to be resonant, but unless you have some kind of component like a small inductor or a small capacitor in line, the harmonics will not line up perfectly with the ham band, and so you'll notice a kind of a valley. But the valley won't follow the ham band. They'll sort of drift away from them unless you have a corrective inductor in line with the end set.
Oh, and that's exactly what happened. On 40 meters, I think the dip is almost perfect, but then as you go higher, the dips shift more than they should.
Okay, well, that means you have a proper end-fed half-wave. You just need to correct for that drift. And the method most people, 9 out of 10 people, more than 9 out of 10 people do, is to put a small inductor to one end of the part that doesn't have the antenna feed. And if you get the inductance right, you will get that shift moved back in line with the ham bands, and that's the sign of a perfectly designed end-fed halfway. You need to have that component to correct for the drift.
Hey, but wouldn't an inductor, wouldn't a coil lengthen the antenna?
No, these are not large, enormous inductors. These are small trimming inductors. They should have minimal effect on your primary frequency, and it should have an increasing effect as it goes up your harmonics, which will reverse the drift that goes up during your harmonics.
Is there a way to come up with the value in microhenries for the inductor?
To my knowledge, no. It might be someplace in some book. The problem, almost every time you take up the subject of microhenries, you know, there's a lot of guesswork involved. I think if you kind of look up guys who design these things for themselves tend to just kind of take a look at it and try something out, and if it doesn't work, try something out and just experiment. Now, how did you experiment a coil in the middle of a wire? Well, you can theoretically, it leaves for a somewhat weaker joint, but you can cut the wire and insert a small coil, connect the two wires temporarily with a clip or something, take some measurements, change the coil out with another one, and keep trying different lengths of wire and different dimensions until you find something you're happy with. I usually the way, if you ever look at things like QST, almost no one has any kind of good explanation of where they came up with the number of turns. They just kind of say, and I tried 7 turns, and it worked. You know, hooray for you. Otherwise, it's black magic to me.
I know. It maddens me when they all do it by, even, you know, YouTube videos, they all do it by the number of turns rather than the, you know, the microhenry value, which, you know, you have different, you know, dimensions of whatever you're winding around, whatever you're using, you know, as the core. You have different dimensions, so they should come up with a microhenry value. You know, I used 4.4 microhenries for this coil. That, you know, if you have a correct meter, which I do, that would be much more helpful than, you know, 7 turns. But we'll see. I'll give it a try. First I'll try the 9-to-1 and see what that gives me, and I'll report back. Thanks, Roy.
Okay, very good. But the way that you described it, that the primary frequency seems to be in the right place and all the others are drifting farther and farther away, is very classical example of what an NFED half wave is. So just by the nature of the drift, it sounds to me like you have close to a half wave NFED. And if you start to play around with 9-to-1, it's going to have totally different behavior than it should.
I'll be very careful. I won't change anything until I'm sure either way, whether just keep the 49-to-1 or replace it with the 9-to-1. I also want to experiment with my vertical portable antenna with the 9-to-1 versus the 49-to-1. We'll see what happens. This is all good stuff. This is what ham radio is about.
Yeah, this is how we all learn stuff. And unfortunately, it's vaguely similar to the fact that most people talk about HF and other frequencies in their wavelength. Because, you know, back in 1905, there was no frequency meters out there. You couldn't tell what your frequency quite was. You had spark gaps, and you just cut a center-fed half-wave dipole to a certain measurement, and that was the resident radiating point for that antenna. And so you spewed it with a lot of harmonic and square wave and spark gaps. Most of the energy went out the way of the resonant circuit that you built at the antenna. So everything was wavelength. Kind of the same thing with microhenries. Up until recently, people couldn't afford VNAs. They couldn't afford sophisticated impedance calculators. They may have voltometers with an oscillator built in that gave you a rough approximation of your capacitances and inductances, but it wasn't accurate enough to really be able to depend on anything. And so people just got into the habit of just eyeing it with their eyes, because a lot cheaper to use an eye, as long as you have one, than it is to use a VNA meter. So I wish you luck, and we're rich, and I'm sure you'll come back and tell us some fascinating stories.
All right. By the way, my LC meter cost all of like $35-$40, and it's a valuable piece of equipment when you're constructing and experimenting with antennas, because of all those little coils and traps that you try to make for them. But like I said, I find it maddening when a guy says, you know, seven turns of number 22 magnetic wire. Seven turns around what, and how is it space and position? So, but I will find out sooner than later. Okay, Roy, thanks.
Okay, good luck, Rich, as always. It's a little bit of a black art, unfortunately. It's still a lot like cooking. You know, we have these recipes, and people pass on these strange comments like two pinches, what the hell is a pinch? Or, you know, tell people to eye it to his, you know, until it's enough, what does that mean? So, yeah, unfortunately, even amateur radio has a lot of cooking lore, and it comes especially to the case of inductors. Good luck, Rich. We'll talk again about it, I'm sure, very soon. Okay, this is Phil AC2GS. This is Phil, the Limark Technical Net. I'm just wondering if anyone out there came by late and has a question that they would like to be put on the list for. One more time. Anyone with another question? Otherwise, we'll definitely go to Westmex, but just curious if anyone has a question, wants to be put on the list.
One question.
Oh, okay. Wes, do you mind if he asks his question first?
No problem at all.
Okie doke, what you got?
Might sound a little silly. FT8 could be used for voice.
Not really. Under what method could you use it for voice? It is a, by definition, it is a low signal, high noise, data transmission that utilizes redundancies and error correction algorithms. So how would you do that with a voice?
Well, it would be digitally, sent. So I must have some sort of sampling rate, even though it may be very small, maybe not in the voice spectrum. But this theoretical, curious question, if it could be used for voice communication at a restricted spectrum.
Again, not really. It uses phase shift keying to elicit a data stream of bits. And the bits are set up in packets. And its protocols include, as I mentioned, error correction algorithm and redundancy, where they send the same data stream more than one time. And they also send some correction codes to kind of rebuild a partially disrupted signal when noise is higher. So you couldn't really do that. I mean, the closest thing to that is the digital voice protocols. And they're a big problem on so many different levels. The data rate for FT8 is very, very small. The symbol rate is slow. That's why very simple concepts take minutes to get across. You know, just to ID yourself and give you an RST strength and such, it takes much longer than you could speak it. So the problem with digital voice is if you digitize the entire voice and try to cram it into a frequency spectrum on UHF or VHF, it would be too wide. It would take up massive quantities of the frequency, and FCC would probably be very upset. Was they compress the actual phonemes, the words that you use to talk into a Fusion or a D-Star or a DMR, first takes a look at your voice, puts it through a decoder, encoder for voice phonemes, and extracts out the bare minimum, turns it into a digital stream that's a fraction of the number of bits that your voice was, and then uses that to modulate the phase shift keying and packaging into these algorithms and packets and such. So the problem is that you wouldn't have the benefit of something that utilizes low symbol rates. If you try to just to say hello, how are you, would probably take about 10 minutes to get across through a similar low symbol rate algorithm that mimics FT8.
Okay, let me just ask a ridiculous follow-up, but maybe not so ridiculous. What about using CW over FT8?
Well, theoretically, I guess you could, but you would have to heavily modify it. And also, since it's not being particularly modulated the same way the CW is, you're using instead phase shift keying so that you could better demodulate it into a bit stream. I guess theoretically, I mean, in practical terms, there is equipment that listens to CW and translates it into letters. So I guess you could theoretically say that's FT8, but without, unfortunately, the lower symbol rate, the redundancy, and the error correction. So you would need to still generate the CW at a power above your noise floor, whereas because of the redundancy and all, you can get away with FT8 being below your noise floor. Now, you can implement the CW-like transmission that includes the same types of redundancy and error correction in some form, and it would sort of sound like CW, but not really. So, you know, it's kind of like, at one point, does it stop being really CW?
Okay, very, very good. Point made. Interesting. But I thank you, as usual.
You're quite welcome. It's an interesting question that I haven't heard, so it's always nice to hear something different. You know, those two guys, Frank and the gentleman with the Nobel Laureate Prize, you know, they're clever guys. They really weren't that interested in JS Call 8. That's the one that they embedded a text field so that you could actually have text conversations back and forth. Makes it a little bit like CW, except that, again, because the symbol rate is slow, and they have to time synchronize signals. So they only kind of get to transfer data one way in 30 seconds a minute. I guess theoretically you can kind of look at it at a very significant variant of CW, JS8 call.
Very well. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome. Thank you. Wes, what do you got for us tonight?
Okay. Enter XGN. Usually I start from point number one, going down. If you look at my email, you have a point number zero. And it says for void to respond. So let me start from one thing. Let's say I have a series of interesting articles or things to all of you, and then at one point you decided that you want to use my services, especially if they are for free. And then in the meantime, I collect information about you. And after I collect the information about you, I start to threaten you. I say that if you don't follow that what I want, I will reveal your affairs to whoever. That means I'm threatening you. So imagine that it's not me right now, but imagine that it's a cloud opus 4 AI. And you are stupid enough or smart enough or whatever you are and you're asking information, and that thing is asking you to give you more information, and then it collects information about you. But then this thing is not a human being. This thing starts to revolt. And it's the question to Dr. Roy. It's Cloud E, Opus 4, AI model, that actually did that. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I don't believe that, by the way, because different places have kind of generated that nonsensical news story repeatedly over a couple of months, and I've listened to enough AI guys where a significant people, a bunch of them, when they bring that up, put a kind of a funny grin on their face, like it's a silly thing. So there's a lot of AI stories that are nonsense, and I tend to think that this particular one right now is. You're alluding to the fact that there are stories that pop up repeatedly, especially for some weird reason, because for Anthropic, that he threatens someone's life. And again, I haven't seen any actual proof. I haven't seen any legitimate sources. They're all kind of, I heard a story. So I tend to think, at least at this point, we're still hearing stories that aren't particularly true. And as I mentioned before, I'm wary of artificial intelligence. I think it's a very, very nice card trick, but I think it's a card trick. I don't think it's conscious. I don't think it's thinking. I think it's solving probabilities for completing sentences, paragraphs, or you know, multiple pages. It's not able to really come up with new ideas, and you know, if you try and get it to write a novel, it kind of goes crazy. Because if it doesn't know where it's going, eventually it hallucinates and makes all kinds of silly things. The entire health department is responsible for a report that they just issued that went through AI, and so it's all nonsense for the most part. So it indicates that the people running the show there are idiots, unfortunately. And there are cases of lawyers who run ChatGPT and the other AIs, you know, through their legal stuff without triple checking it, and then the judge throws the book at them. So, again, I don't think it's ready for prime time. I know the guys who are in charge of trying to be the first trillionaire want to give you the impression that any day it's going to be a superhuman intelligence that will rule the world and give you everything you ever wanted for free. These guys are used car salesmen at the very worst.
Okay, enter again. Thank you very much for the opinion in this matter. The information says that the report reveals 84% test. So it was a test, and maybe it is not a consciousness, but it is just the form of response that was implemented by another human being who knows and who has a conscious ability to thinking, and who knows that this is possible. And that response was nothing but one of the ways of the AI system to respond back to you.
There are a lot of AI guys who are a little squirrely. There was that guy over at Google who either was fired or he quit because he decided that his AI was conscious and that it wasn't. So just because you have a degree and just because you're in the middle of it doesn't mean that you can't go a little bit crazy. A lot of unfortunate scientists have gone crazy through the years. Even our beloved Nikola, he was a little squirrely at the end. He was engaged to a pigeon at the end. So unfortunately, great minds crack occasionally. And so I think a lot of AI guys either crack or are just running a scam. There's a lot of very good literature that demonstrates that generative AI is a specific type of AI that's easy to get right up front, but inevitably leads to a brick wall and you get stopped. Those guys are waiting for them to hit the brick wall. Other guys who are looking to get $1 trillion are saying, there's no such thing as a brick wall. He's going to be a god as soon as we build him. I'm kind of worried either way, if they're completely lying to us or if they're crazy enough to want an AI god. Would you want an AI god? I don't want an AI god. I have no reason to believe an AI god is...